Hello, I'm Kevin Moore, and welcome to another edition of The Moore Show, which is sponsored by the UFO Matrix magazine. On today's show, I'll be joined with St. John Hunt, whose father, E. Howard Hunt, had direct knowledge of the planning, the participants, and the motives in the assassination of JFK, and confided and entrusted this information to his son, St. John. But first on the show, I'm about to be joined with Joan Millen. Now, Joan is a professor in the Department of English at Temple University in the USA, and an author of 17 books. Her latest book, A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison's JFK Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History, begins with Jim Garrison's New Orleans investigation of the Kennedy assassination, and contains a biographical look at Jim Garrison, the man who became the only public official ever to bring anyone connected with the murder of President Kennedy before the bar of justice. Joan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kevin.
Now, Joan, why should we still care about the JFK story nowadays?
Well, that's a very good question. And there's a long answer to that one. I think the answer to that is that what we saw in the murder of President Kennedy predicted the 21st century politics that we see today. What John F. Kennedy fought against, which was the CIA intruding on the powers of elected officials in the United States government, has come to pass. And the Kennedy assassination predicted, really, everything that would follow. Number one, the extension of a ground war in Vietnam, which happened almost immediately after President Kennedy died. And then the era that we have now of permanent war, in which we have serial wars, long wars, wars that last as long as they possibly can, military bases of the United States all over the world, wars ready in the wings, waiting to happen. When one dies down, another flares up, military bases everywhere ready to accommodate these wars. And all that, I think, is predicted by the war in Vietnam, which had no more point than the war in Afghanistan today. And I think the point of these wars is not victory. There is no such thing as victory, but how long they last. The longer, the better. And this is very frightening. And I think some of my students often, you know, periodically would say, well, why does, just your question, Kevin, why does the Kennedy assassination matter? It matters because it ushered in an entire new era of American politics, American identity, American role in the world, much more important and definitive even than that post-war moment in 1945. So it's a frightening moment, but after all, what we have here is the murder of the head of state. And we have a murder where we have a cover-up that begins before the murder even took place. We have a situation where public officials lied about what happened, and a crime that has never really been resolved, and many people feel never will be, because some of the people who knew a lot about what happened are no longer with us. They died, as one author wrote in reference to Richard Helms, he died with his secrets. So we don't really have the witnesses around anymore that could enlighten us on who planned this crime. And I don't think it really matters. And Jim Garrison, certainly in New Orleans, didn't think it mattered who actually did the shooting on November 22nd. He was concerned with trying to figure out who plotted the crime.
Now, obviously, we're going to discuss Jim Garrison in the interview, but just for the listeners out there who aren't too sure who Jim Garrison was, could just describe how you came to meet Jim Garrison and what his main job was.
Okay. Jim Garrison was the district attorney in Orleans Parish. And in the state of Louisiana, the state is divided up into parishes. So there's no city of New Orleans as far as the district attorney is concerned. It's Orleans Parish. Garrison was born in Iowa. He went to Louisiana with his mother at a very young age when he was a boy, grew up there, and was elected in 1962 to be, which is something that probably people even in the United States wouldn't know, that is an enormously powerful office of District Attorney of Orleans Parish, perhaps even more powerful than the office of Governor of the state of Louisiana. I came to know Jim Garrison because my husband had been living in London, and he had been given a series of articles from an Italian newspaper called Paese Sera, which is a communist newspaper, and they had done a series of articles on a CIA front called Permindex, which was based in Switzerland and also in Rome. And in the course of this series of articles, Clay Shaw, who was the managing director of the International Trademark in New Orleans, was mentioned as being on the board of directors of the Rome affiliate of Permindex. And this was in March of 1967. 2 weeks earlier, Jim Garrison had arrested Clay Shaw on March 1, 1967, for conspiracy in the murder of President Kennedy. So now, here is Clay Shaw arrested for this crime and also connected to a CIA front organization. And Garrison had believed, really, when he started to study Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans, he said, in joking, really, half-joking, referring to the Warren Report, which said that Oswald was the lone assassin and that he was a loner and that he didn't have any friends, he was so forth. And Garrison said not only was Oswald never alone, but everyone he was with was somehow connected to CIA. Now, here's Clay Shaw, whom Garrison suspected of having been assigned by CIA to take care of Oswald during the period that Oswald was in Louisiana, which was from April 1963 until late September 1963. Here's Shaw, exposed in an Italian newspaper as having definite CIA connections. It wasn't a guess. And we have to remember that all of Garrison's investigation took place before the passage in 1992, which was the year of his death, of the John F. Kennedy Act, Collections and Records Act, which meant that there was a release of thousands and thousands of documents from FBI and CIA and other agencies to the general public, to the National Archives. And Garrison was trying to understand who Clay Shaw was without any of those records. Once those records were released in 1992 and in the years following, then Shaw's CIA files emerged, and we could see that he was an operative of the CIA's clandestine services, that he was doing assignments for CIA, and all the reports are there. And we learned that Shaw had files in various components of CIA, not a domestic contact service, yes, where they debrief businessmen, but also the clandestine services, what was known then as the DDP, the Deputy Director for Plans. And he was involved with that, and he was, there's a huge CIA record of its involvement with Clay Shaw. And only recently, and I think, you know, documents are still emerging, a document has emerged from the CIA's own history group. That is, CIA has a component that charts its own history. And a document has emerged for internal use, not for the general public in particularly, but it has been released, which says that Clay Shaw was a highly paid agent of CIA. And the words highly paid just blow away all the denials that the Clay Shaw people and that people who have criticized Jim Garrison have been making over the years. Shaw was a highly paid CIA employee.
So obviously,
big. I didn't have that in my book because I've only just come across this document, very kindly given to me by a researcher from the UK, and there it is.
So obviously, David Ferry, let's sum this up. David Ferry was the CIA contract pilot, and Clay Shaw was also a CIA operative. Now, initially, Garrison arrested David Ferry, and through that arrest, obviously, it led on to Clay Shaw. Now, didn't David Ferry meet a nasty end before he could be taken to trial?
David Ferry and Clay Shaw, I think the most important incident that Garrison's investigation revealed are the trips that Clay Shaw and David Ferry took together with Lee Harvey Oswald up to the two towns north of Baton Rouge. And Oswald went up there to try to get a job, believe it or not, in an insane asylum in the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson, and who drove him up there in a black Cadillac, Clay Shaw, and David Ferry is along. And, of course, Oswald had known David Ferry since he was a teenager. Oswald was a teenager when he was in the Civil Air Patrol, and David Ferry led a young group of the Civil Air Patrol, and I have a photograph in A Farewell to Justice of a cookout of that group where you see Ferry and you see Oswald together in the same photograph. Now, David Ferry, as you say, was Garrison's chief suspect, and Garrison was just about to arrest Ferry, and then suddenly Ferry dies. Now, how he died is not known. There was some. Did he just die? Did he have an aneurysm? Did somebody kill him and make it look as if he had an aneurysm? It's very unclear. But the point was that Ferry died. And I think one of the interesting things about Garrison is that when Ferry died like that, several assistant district attorneys went into Garrison's office and they said, okay, they were relieved, it's over. This ball is rolling down the hill, one of them said. And Garrison just said, what do you mean? I'm just beginning. So, okay, Garrison lost his chief suspect, Ferry, but he still went on, because after all, whenever where Oswald was, there was also Shaw.
So
he had Shaw, and that was just as good as having Ferry.
So, did when the 1969 trial came about, did Garrison actually expose the links that Oswald had to the CIA?
Well, afterwards, Garrison's focus once he was on trial was on Shaw. Oswald is dead now, so he's not in the trial. And Garrison did not mention CIA. The prosecution did not mention CIA, and that was because he had no hard evidence. The Paese Sera newspaper, after all, is hearsay. You can't use a newspaper, let alone a newspaper from Rome, in court of law in the United States. Garrison had no proof that Shaw was actually with CIA. So it was actually Shaw's attorney, Irvin Diamond, who said, have you ever asked Shaw? Shaw's on the stand testifying. And Diamond said, have you ever been associated with CIA? And Shaw denied it. He lied on the stand.
So what got
Did you ever know David Ferry? He lied on the stand. And there were so many witnesses that saw Ferry and Shaw and Oswald together up there in Clinton and Jackson. It didn't matter. You see, I think that Shaw felt that he was being protected by higher authority and he didn't have to worry. And indeed, he was being protected because he didn't have to worry. Not only was he acquitted, but when Garrison attempted to bring him to trial afterward for perjury, the case suddenly found itself in federal court, even though it was a state case, it's not a federal case, and the federal judge dismissed it. So Shaw got off scot-free.
So in your opinion then, why was Garrison so obsessed with this particular case?
Garrison identified with John F. Kennedy. He admired John F. Kennedy. He thought of himself as a public figure similar to John F. Kennedy. Garrison, for example, was very involved in civil rights and protecting African-American people in Louisiana at the time. This was during the civil rights movement that he was elected. And he saw in Kennedy a kindred spirit. Kennedy also got elected as a result of being successful at a debate on television. Same thing happened to Garrison. And so I think Garrison really, he loved John F. Kennedy, and he felt that part of the story, part of the crime, happened in his jurisdiction, since Oswald was in New Orleans from April to September, and so he felt that it was his responsibility to try to, if he could, to bring somebody to justice. Garrison is the only public official in the United States ever to bring anybody before the bar of justice for involvement in the murder of President Kennedy. And after all, when during the weekend of the assassination, somebody called Clay Bertrand called up a lawyer, small-time mob lawyer in New Orleans named Dean Andrews, and said, would you go to Dallas and represent Lee Harvey Oswald? And Clay Bertrand turned out to be Clay Shaw. And Garrison had good proof that Bertrand and Shaw were one and the same. So if Bertrand is Shaw, and Bertrand is involved in trying to get Oswald a lawyer, Shaw has something to do with the assassination. That was brought out in court quite well, but it still wasn't enough. It was too shocking for people to try to make that connection, to say that Shaw is with the CIA and that the CIA, that an agency of the United States government, should have something to do with the murder of the president, was beyond what people could accept. And I think, by the way, that's still true today. If you say, why does the Kennedy assassination matter? One of the reasons it matters is that it points to the resistance here of the general public and the mainstream media to deal with hard questions, to deal with what's really going on and who's doing what to whom. And I think that the public here has just been reluctant. And of course, the CIA has conducted a campaign since the 60s to attack Garrison, to discredit Garrison, to talk about his health, his sexuality, to talk about all sorts of things that have nothing to do with anything, is a constant discrediting of Garrison, and it suggests that Garrison is a threat in some way. And the truths of the Garrison investigation are a threat to those who had something to do with this crime. Because the National Archives now, with the millions of documents that have been released since 1992, everything that I found corroborates what Garrison was thinking. Garrison's theories, Garrison's what Garrison put forward, it's all been corroborated by the documents, and these are official government documents. And I think that very even newspapers here, many of them very reluctant to admit that. I don't know about over there, but right here there's a tremendous resistance to a truth like this. It's too dark. Just there are many truths that are just too dark, and the idea that we're at permanent war, it's frightening, isn't it? I mean, and yet that's just what seems to be happening.
So did the name Jack Ruby come up in Garrison's investigations? And just for the listeners, you know, who was Jack Ruby?
Jack Ruby was a small-time mobster who was in Dallas, who had been originally from Chicago, had mafia ties, and was also an FBI informant, and in Dallas ran a club called the Carousel Club. And on the weekend of the assassination, the Sunday morning, President Kennedy was killed on Friday afternoon, on Sunday morning, Jack Ruby finds his way into the Dallas police headquarters, where Oswald has been brought down because they're moving him from one place to another, and Ruby takes a gun out of his pocket and shoots Oswald at point-blank range and kills him. Now, Ruby is asked, well, why did you do that? And he says, because he felt so sorry for Jackie Kennedy. And one of the tasks of any investigation, the Warren Commission really defaulted on this one, but Garrison was trying to show that Ruby and Oswald knew each other. And there's a lot, an enormous amount of evidence to that effect. But again, remember that the Garrison trial had to do with Clay Shaw's involvement in proving that. Whether Oswald and Ruby knew each other now, we see, is not part of the Garrison trial. But, of course, it's part of the investigation because it's part of the notion that this must have been a conspiracy. What is Ruby doing killing Oswald? And I found myself in my own investigation retracing the steps of the Garrison investigation, that there were many witnesses I found and many more that others knew about as well that knew that Oswald and Ruby knew each other very well. And one of my own witnesses, his name was Thomas Edward Beckham, and he appears in the last chapter of my book, regretting that he didn't tell Jim Garrison the truth. Well, Beckham recounted to me how at the time he said, how could Jack do that to Lee? That they knew each other was well known. And yet, of course, he did. And the first person who went to see Jack Ruby in jail after Ruby had killed Oswald was a small-time mafia figure from Louisiana. So all of this is connected. Garrison investigated whether the mafia was involved. Many people, fearing, you know, trying to discredit Garrison, have said that he was protecting the mafia, and that was why he blamed Shaw, which nothing could be further from the truth. What would Garrison have to do with the mafia? For one thing, if you have something to do with the mafia, it's because money is involved. Garrison never had a dime. And I think one of the coroner of Orleans Parish told me he opened Garrison's desk one day and all these uncashed checks are there, which were Garrison's salary from his National Guard. Never bothered to cash them. The police officer who was Garrison's driver, Steve Bordelon, told me he emptied Garrison's pockets every night when he brought him home. No, there was never any money at all. And Garrison used to say, buy me a cigar, get me the newspaper. He never paid anybody back. He never even touched money. His children had to work their way through college. So the idea that somehow Garrison is protecting the mafia and taking payoffs, it's nice to, you know, what else are you going to say, but it just wasn't true. And in the early 1970s, the federal government tried to frame Garrison for taking bribes from pinball interests in Louisiana. At that time, you could play pinball, but if a bar paid off on pinball games, that was a crime. And Garrison was acquitted. He, in fact, at the end, he represented himself, and he gave the closing statement, which was one of his more elaborate literary efforts, and he said the last perfect person who walked the earth was 2,000 years ago. He was not perfect, but he didn't do this thing, and he was acquitted in quite easily.
So,
but he was exhausted, and he had to run for re-election as district attorney in 1973, and he couldn't campaign. He was exhausted. He was, he lost by 2,200 votes. As a result of losing the office of district attorney, he no longer had the apparatus for continuing his investigation. So that was the big loss, because Garrison didn't really care anymore about crime, and he let his assistants do all the cases. All he was interested in was the Kennedy assassination, which gets back to your question, why? It's just because it was his cause. He believed in it. It made him, I would argue, a hero. It made him rise above the ordinary. In many ways, he was an ordinary man. In many ways, not. And it's, but in this the dedication to trying to find out who killed President Kennedy, Jim Garrison rose above.
So the main lead character, Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone assassin that's supposed to have killed or shot JFK a number of times, he's taken out by Jack Ruby. Now, what happened to Jack Ruby in the end?
Jack Ruby, of course, was easily apprehended, went to jail, and there's the most interesting incident, and it's well known. It's not the research is not original to me, but the most interesting moment came when Earl Warren went to with some other members of the Warren Commission. They went to visit Jack Ruby in jail, and Ruby said, "Take me to Washington. I really want to tell you something, but I can't do it here." He was afraid to do it in Dallas, and Earl Warren says, "We don't have the money." I mean, it was really ludicrous. "We don't have the money. We don't have the expense account, whatever." And they refused to take Ruby to Washington where he could testify there. So he never really spoke out. He never said what he knew. And then he contracted cancer. And Jim Garrison wrote a short story in which we see a figure in the friend of David Ferry's called Mary Sherman, who was doing cancer experiments at the United States Public Health Hospital in New Orleans, injecting Jack Ruby with cancer cells. But that was a work of fiction. We don't know. Ruby contracted cancer and died. He never really told what he knew. He never told who hired him. He just never told. Which is universally true in this case, that people that knew a lot did not talk. It was were abused and criticized and racially attacked in court by Clay Shaw's lawyer had the guts to come forward and go down to New Orleans and testify that they saw Shaw, Ferry, and Oswald up there in Clinton and Jackson. That was amazing. And the Shaw defense lied, and they tried to say that there was a conspiracy among these people, but they were black and white. And at that, one of the witnesses up there told me, and she asked me about a certain person who was white. Is he white? They would never have spoken to each other, black and white, in 1963. The segregation was total at that time up in these little cities north of Baton Rouge.
So John F. Kennedy, I mean, he had many enemies on so many different fronts. I mean, he was hated by the Cubans, the mobs. Obviously, there was the pending war in Vietnam. Do all these tie up to the murder of JFK? And do any of these have a part in his death, in your opinion?
Well, the Vietnamese had nothing against John F. Kennedy. Well, he did send special forces and advisors to Vietnam. But I think that... Who you're saying, who are the real enemies? The biggest enemy that John F. Kennedy had, from John F. Kennedy's point of view, was the CIA. And if you look at the history of that, of his presidency, you see constant warfare with the CIA. John F. Kennedy trying to take away their powers. John F. Kennedy setting up a defense intelligence agency. John F. Kennedy trying to take away the power of CIA over the U-2 overflights over Cuba. John F. Kennedy trying to cut the budget of CIA, CIA fighting back against Kennedy, CIA giving information, for example, about the Cuban missiles. CIA is supposed to report to the president, but they didn't, and they gave their information to a senator who was on their side called Senator Kenneth Keating of New York, and Keating gets up on the floor of the Senate and starts talking about the Soviet missiles in Cuba, and Kennedy is looking at this and saying, well, where did he get that information? He didn't have it. So there was real warfare. CIA was told by Kennedy not to get involved in the assassination of Trujillo. CIA did it anyway, provided all the arms for the assassins of Trujillo. CIA was making policy. CIA involved itself in the murder of Diem in Vietnam, and we, as ordinary citizens, people wouldn't have known. You blame Kennedy. You blame the government. It wasn't true. And CIA just went ahead. In fact, Kennedy had given orders to the American ambassador in Saigon, Henry Cabot Lodge, no friend of Kennedy's, not to let CIA get involved with this. And Lodge couldn't stop them. And they were involved in the assassination of Diem. So CIA and Kennedy were at war. And Kennedy gave the famous quote, "I'm going to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and toss them to the winds," quoted in many places, including in the New York Times. The source unacknowledged, and I think they had more power than he had. And one of the soldiers of fortune involved in the anti-Castro movement said to me, John F. Kennedy was the last president who thought he could take power. So obviously he didn't. And the other, to answer your question, you really needed the people closest to Kennedy to come forward and explain to you exactly what was going on inside that administration. They have not done so. And Arthur Schlesinger was a likely person who knew and should have spoken out, and he thought he didn't. But one day I had a friend of mine who was a friend of his go to meet Schlesinger, supposedly by accident, at the Century Association, which is a private club, and just ask him casually, who do you think killed President Kennedy? And then he would report back to me, because I don't think Schlesinger would have told me. And Schlesinger said to him, his name was Wilmer Thomas, Schlesinger said, we were at war with the national security people. Well, that's a statement, isn't it? He never said it for the public record, but he sure said it. And I think that just tells us that Schlesinger and others knew well exactly what was going on there between Kennedy and the CIA. Now, I wrote to Ted Sorensen at the time, whom I knew socially a bit, and I wrote him and I asked him about that quote, splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and toss them to the winds. And he said he never heard it, which couldn't possibly be the case. The Kennedy family, somebody wrote me an email today saying, how do you account for the Kennedy family, later generations, never speaking out, never investigating, never helping anybody who's doing the investigation, never lending a hand to this? And in fact, Bobby Kennedy tried to stop Jim Garrison. And that's a big subject. I think it hasn't been discussed enough. Anyway, the fact is that they haven't. They have not. Now, fear was obviously in the early days. You could say that fear of the consequences. Jackie was frightened for that the consequences might come to her children. But, of course, looking back, Garrison always thought that if Bobby Kennedy had come forward, if Bobby Kennedy had demanded the truth, he would have saved his own life. That the worst thing he could have done was to keep silent about what he knew, because then he gave his own assassins good reason to kill him. So it was very upsetting, because Garrison couldn't understand why Bobby Kennedy was so against his investigation. And Garrison said on television, he said, if it were my brother, I'd want to know what happened to him.
Yeah.
And I think Bobby Kennedy, of course, probably did want to know, but he also had high ambitions. And I think that if Bobby Kennedy came out and suggested that there was some intra-government warfare between President Kennedy and CIA and whatever, he could never have become president of the United States, and that was what he wanted.
Well, was it also...
That's another story. It's about American politics.
Was it also Garrison's opinion that perhaps John Edgar Hoover, the first director of the FBI, also... much disliked JFK and Bobby. Did Garrison feel that he could have been involved somewhere in a conspiracy to cover up the truth?
No. Well, to cover up the truth, I think Hoover went along with the cover-up. I think that's pretty obvious. Was Hoover involved? I don't think so. Because I have information that on November 17th, Hoover sent out a teletype to various field offices of the FBI, New Orleans, Dallas, Houston, various ones, and which it said that there's warning that there might be an incident against President Kennedy the weekend of November 22nd. Now, that was disseminated within the FBI, and a person, the clerk of the New Orleans field office, a young man then named William Walter, kept the original. So he still has the original of that teletype. Now, Hoover sending out that teletype is obviously not in on it, because why would he would never send out such a teletype if he were involved in the planning of the assassination? I don't think so. He had news that he had information that something was going to happen. And people, there were people who knew. As far as the cover-up is concerned, then I think the forces of power banded together and all aided in the cover-up. And Garrison never thought that the FBI was involved in the plotting of the assassination. He certainly took note of the fact that the FBI did everything it could during his investigation to shut him down, including sending informants into his office, and they would report on stealing documents, finding out what he was up to, and lying. And I think that was true. And I think that they were, it's not so simple, because some of the people who were in the FBI at the time, also in New Orleans, they had loyalty to the FBI as an institution, which prevented them from really telling what they knew. There was a moment there early on when Oswald was in New Orleans, he he had an FBI, he was an FBI informant himself, and his FBI handler was named Warren DeBruys. And one day, DeBruys went up to a Cuban who ran a clothing store in New Orleans named Carlos Briniere, who's well known for having gotten into a street fight with Oswald on Canal Street over the Fair Play for Cuba leaflets. And DeBruys went into Briniere's store and just made a remark, a kind of smart remark, and said, "I can infiltrate you anytime." And several days later, Oswald walks in to the store. And now we know that Oswald and DeBruys were working together in the FBI, because the same William Walter, whom I mentioned, has reported that he found file jackets in the FBI field office there, and both names, DeBruys and Oswald, were on them. So I asked Mr. DeBruys about this, and he said, "That's far-fetched." He had testified that none of this was true, and he wasn't going to go back on that. Later, when my book, A Farewell to Justice, was about to come out, I called Mr. DeBruys one last time. And what he said to me, I thought was interesting. He didn't admit that he had sent Oswald to bring me a store, but what he said was, "It wouldn't be a very intelligent person who never changed their mind." What does he say? Now, that is, to me, is saying, I may think differently now, or I may say, I would have, if I were testifying today, I might say something different than what I said then. But that's as far as I could get. I respect him, I respect his respect for the FBI and for the office that he held, and I understand. This was very difficult for people who were caught in a situation, and really, when you think that, what were they going to do? They had to protect the government, they had to protect the office against what actually happened. One of the a documentary filmmaker has an interesting quote. His name was Alan Frankovich, and he did a four-part series on history of the CIA. And in the preface, he wrote a little prologue, and he said, "I could find no rogue elephants rampaging through history," which meant these were not some isolated operatives, these weren't who did this crime, these were not some people that were going against the institution of CIA, this was right at the heart of it. And I think we have to live with the fact that I'm not the only one who said so, and I really don't think the heavens will not fall, as to quote a writer who lived in the UK, Joseph Conrad, in Heart of Darkness, at the end, when Marlowe considers whether or not to tell the truth to Kurtz's intended. And he lies, and he says the heavens did not fall. The heavens don't fall, really. If you tell the truth, the heavens won't fall. I think that we underestimate people if we think that they can't stand the truth. I think they can, and I think we need the truth. I taught a course this last semester at Temple University in the Kennedy assassination first time, and there were these young people who had no preconceived ideas, had no idea of what happened, were looking at this and wondering what happened, and were amazed at some of the things that they found. For example, a consular officer in the Soviet Union, when Oswald defected, so-called defected, and went over there and said he wants to renounce his American citizenship and so forth, his name was Richard Snyder, and I produced the documents that showed that Richard Snyder had been a longtime CIA operative, suddenly now is in the State Department and is working in Moscow at the moment Oswald shows up in the American embassy. This is mind-boggling. And yet, people are resilient. They can stand the truth, I think so. Oswald did not defect. He was part of a CIA counterintelligence operation. Many documents have emerged that revealed that. Many CIA operatives have said Oswald was never debriefed by CIA. The debriefing information has come forward, has appeared, showing that Oswald was debriefed by CIA in New York City when it came back from the Soviet Union in June of 1962, along with other of the people who were participants in the false defector program. The heavens are not falling with the emergence of this material. That we have documents that show that some of the CIA people who had been part of the Soviet Russia division of CIA were wanting to use Oswald and wondered there's something strange about him, and were not informed by other components of CIA that he was already being used. So we see CIA as such a complex institution in which one component doesn't know what the others are doing. Everything is truly on a need-to-know basis.
Well, okay, I just want to go back to the Vietnam issue, just to get that sort of covered. In your opinion, then, did Kennedy want to go to war with Vietnam, or was he, you know, against it in a sense?
I think in the deepest sense, Kennedy did send, I must, you know, we have to admit, Kennedy did send advisors, Green Berets, to Vietnam. Kennedy did not want a Vietnam war, and Kennedy resisted the advice of his cabinet, Dean Rusk, McNamara, and McGeorge Bundy, who was his national security advisor. They, and every day after day, they were begging, send ground troops, send troops to Vietnam. And Kennedy, standing alone with no one behind him, said no and refused. And the documentation for this comes in a most unusual place. It comes in McGeorge Bundy's autobiography. Well, he died before the autobiography was finished, so it was the person who completed it was the person, his co-author, Gordon Goldstein. And the book is called Lessons in Disaster. And there we see McGeorge Bundy admitting and recounting how there was nonstop pressure on John F. Kennedy to send ground troops to Vietnam, and he resisted. He didn't want to do it. He didn't see the point of it. Now, I think there were many reasons for that, the cruelty of it, the absurdity of it, the deficit that would be created by it, and I think we can see that this country is going bankrupt by these foreign wars today. If you're asking how the Kennedy assassination matters, Kennedy, I think, was very mindful of the fact that the country couldn't afford these things like Vietnam War. And we see today that this country is bankrupt, practically, and yet they keep on fighting these meaningless wars. There's a direct connection between the two. But I think there's no question in my mind, as soon as John F. Kennedy was gone, they started sending troops, ground troops, to Vietnam. And Lyndon Johnson, really, in all fairness to him, I don't think it was his idea. I think he wanted to go down in history as the architect of what he called the Great Society and poverty programs, Head Start programs, Civil Rights Act. He did not want this Vietnam War, and he was forced into it. I don't think he had a choice, which goes back to the quote that I gave earlier saying that John F. Kennedy was the last president who thought he could take power. And this is really ironic because Lyndon Johnson always wanted power. He wanted it. He begged for it. He stole the election of 1948 to get into the United States Senate. Every corruption you can think of because he wanted power. He gets to be president, and he finds out that the script is being handed to him, and then he had no power whatsoever. That war was going forward, which suggests that the people who wanted that war were also the people that had something to do with the assassination of President Kennedy.
And also the money they would have made from the war as well.
Absolutely. Why did they want the war? They wanted it because, and I think it's a very interesting detail, which we know, that Brown and Root, the construction company, which was sold to Halliburton in 1962, the year before the Kennedy assassination, made billions and billions of dollars from contracts in Vietnam. And then, of course, we see them in Iraq again, and then they went out of hand. They got it so out of hand that Halliburton had to get rid of Brown and Root in 2007, but it served its purpose. And it wasn't only Brown and Root, but Brown and Root got the lion's share. It was also Bechtel. It was also other Bell Helicopter and all of these defense contractors in whose interest it is not only for these wars to be fought, but for them to be prolonged. They are facilitators of war. If they're building the bases and the food and the laundry and everything else connected with war, they're doing it for the long haul. They're not about to leave anytime soon. And they're making those billions, and the billions are lost, millions are lost, vanished, theft, every which corruption, and yet it keeps on going. Well, what does that have to do? How come these defense contractors, these intel org companies, these seem to get their way? What relationship do they have to power? Well, who is their benefactor? Who takes care of their interests? That's been CIA. And that's the subject, by the way, I should add, of my new book, which is being published by a publisher called Bloomsbury, which is a UK-based publisher, but they have offices in the United States. And then the new book is called Texas Robber Barons, which means Brown and Root and many others, and CIA, because this is what flowed from the Vietnam War, and it explains what's going on today, and it shows the history of these people with CIA. It's not, and they have direct connections. They have been CIA assets. This is documented, and a lot of the documentation came to me from the very JFK Act, where so much of the documentation and the files in the National Archives have nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination directly, but they expose all of these relationships. Some scholars, mainstream scholars, may not want to go and look at this stuff because they don't want to be tainted by involvement in the Kennedy assassination. But if they had, people like Robert Caro, who is doing, he's doing the biography of Lyndon Johnson and won't touch this material, well, too bad, because he's lost a lot of important information about his subject, Lyndon Johnson, and Lyndon Johnson's connections, and the Brown and Root connection, which Garrison even looked at. That's, of course, how some of it came out.
So, putting a sort of cap on the Vietnam issue then, there's some history books would say, though, that he was very sort of, John F. Kennedy was very anti-communist, and he was also concerned that, it was going to sort of spread to other regions. Would you take that on board?
Kennedy, when he began in the United States Senate, you're absolutely right, Kevin, was a Cold War liberal. He believed in the Cold War. He was an anti-communist, all of that. And yet, he was not willing to send ground troops to Laos or to Vietnam or to any of these places. I think that maybe he evolved. Maybe he realized that this was a direction that the United States should not be going to. It doesn't mean that he was the Prince of Peace. It doesn't mean that he didn't want the Vietnamese to lose. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying he was a socialist or that he was going against the mainstream. But he certainly didn't want a bloody ground war in Vietnam, and he saw no point to it. They hadn't done anything to us, And the domino theory, that was the hard line of people like Bundy and his brother William Bundy, who worked for the CIA for many years. And William Bundy came out with the domino theory. Only in 1965, he went to the Dallas Council on World Affairs and gave that domino theory, and he said, Thailand is next. Well, Thailand wasn't next. Now, was it? And he went there to say that, to justify the Vietnam War, but they only went to justify the Vietnam War after Kennedy was dead. They went to, the Dallas Council on World Affairs was one of these CIA affiliated organizations where CIA propaganda is disseminated. And there's one in New York called the Council on Foreign Relations, and there are these various councils in different cities in the United States. And Bundy went there to talk about the domino theory only in 1965. So I think Kennedy was not a proponent of the domino theory. And I know that Kennedy had contradictory policies. I think Kennedy, like Obama today, what they want is to get reelected. And so Kennedy seemed to pursue contradictory paths. On the one hand, he was involved himself in a rapprochement with Castro, right? He sent his emissary, William Atwood, and he was going to talk to Castro. On the other hand, he's, befriending the Cubans and all this, and he's anti-Castro. So he's trying to have it all ways and talking about how Castroism can't spread in Latin America and the Alliance for Progress and so forth. So he was a devious politician. He wasn't a straight-up idealist. I am not one of those people who believe that. But certainly, after reading that book, the story of McGeorge Bundy and his life, I have to give Kennedy some credit for resisting that pressure to send troops to Vietnam. So, and I think his brother, Bobby Kennedy, said the same thing to Daniel Ellsberg. You can find it in Ellsberg's memoir where he discusses an interview with Bobby Kennedy and what would your brother have done. And Bobby said, I think that he would have created a coalition government maybe in Vietnam that was similar to what happened in Laos. I'm not defending any of that, but I'm just saying that he wasn't the worst, and I think he saw this looming militarism, and I think it took Kennedy's presidency for him to realize the pernicious forces that work inside the United States government, and in particular CIA. Now, we also have evidence of Kennedy and Bobby, the two of them, involved in plots to, assassination plots against Castro. So on the same person who was sending rapprochement, sending William Atwood and all these people to make friends with Castro, on the other, he's also sponsoring, especially Bobby, assassination plots against Castro. And that's all been documented. People don't want to look at that, but there it is. So we don't want to idealize the Kennedys. I don't see that gets us anywhere. But on the other hand, we certainly, I think when we compare, comparisons are odious, right, and also from the UK said that. But we still have to say that compared with some of the things with the antics that we see going on in the Obama administration, Kennedy was better, far better.
I mean, isn't it mad that, you know, some 40 years after Kennedy's death and more, you know, that Fidel Castro, you know, still stayed in power?
Yes, which could only lead us to believe that he was protected in some way, not only by his own, but by CIA itself. I can't imagine that CIA, if they really hadn't wanted to kill him, they couldn't have done it. It just seems incomprehensible. And that's the subject of my new book, partly. I discuss that issue, really. What did CIA really want in relation to the fate of Fidel Castro? They killed many people. When they wanted to, they managed to do it. They killed the President of the United States, in my opinion. So, what they seem to be doing, sponsoring, for example, a lot of anti-Castro activity, what we find when we scratch beneath the surface is that they sabotaged the very efforts that they themselves sponsored. They are dark, and they are not what they seem. The motives really require a deep understanding. Let's just put it that way. Based on their actions, based on their deeds. Many people who worked with them in those years, the 50s, 60s, said, were disillusioned.
Yeah.
One of the characters in my book refers to them as the friends, with quotation marks always around the word friends.
So, in your opinion, then, I mean, we've got Lee Harvey Oswald, the sole assassin in the JFK case. In your opinion, was he a patsy, or truly did he shoot JFK?
Jim Garrison thought that he didn't even get off a shot. The idea that he could have killed JFK is inconceivable from every scientific, ballistic, or acoustic. All the people who are your forensic specialists could do better than I in proving that. There's no question that he didn't kill President Kennedy. Did he get off a shot? Well, Garrison looked at the paraffin tests, and his office, of course, being an office of a district attorney, would look at whatever forensic details that they could find, and they concluded that he hadn't even fired a shot because there was no paraffin, you know, gunpowder traces on his cheek, which would have been the result of having if he had shot John F. Kennedy with that gun that he had up there. So I don't think, and finally Garrison had to say it didn't matter. What mattered was who sat there and planned it, who controlled it, who organized it. It was a hugely organized event. And Garrison really, he has to get credit. Well, some of the people, for example, the person I mentioned earlier, Thomas Edward Beckham, was involved in the conspiracy. Now, Garrison eventually, through efforts, got him before a grand jury in New Orleans Parish, and Beckham lied and just denied everything, denied knowing everyone whom he knew, denied knowing Oswald, denied knowing Shaw, and all this. And when I interviewed Beckham, he said to me that he wished he could call Jim Garrison and could say that he was, because Garrison had called Beckham the day after, or maybe the same day after Beckham testified before the grand jury. Garrison, pathetic. I mean, here's the district attorney of Orleans Parish calling this two-bit character kid and saying, "Well, was I close?" Garrison saying, "Was I close?" And Beckham said to me, this is all these years later, said, "I wish I could have told him how close he was." And I ended the book there because I thought, whoa, that is, what Garrison showed there, contrary to all the efforts to discredit Garrison, was his humility as a person. He didn't really care if he's talking to you or a kid or a person of no account or whomever. He just wanted to know if the truth. He wanted to know what happened to President Kennedy. Who else can claim, and certainly no public official, any other public official in any jurisdiction, including Dallas, can claim to that kind of commitment? After all, it's the President of the United States. Doesn't that count for anything? I think in the demeaned culture that we find today, nothing counts for anything. There's no respect for anything. And the truth is elusive. And here's Garrison, actually very idealistic, very believing that he can find the truth if he works hard enough, he interviews enough people, if he examines enough evidence, he's going to be able to get to the truth. And he got close. And I think that he should get credit. He was a hero, if there is such a thing as a hero. And I always thought that I didn't believe in the great man view of history and heroes, but I think Garrison was a hero, definitely a hero.
So in your opinion...
And when the House Select Committee investigated the Kennedy assassination, Garrison had nothing to do with that, in the 1970s, in the late 1970s, and the New Orleans people, the two police investigators who were working for the United States government on the House Select Committee, spoke to Garrison, of course, and one day one of them, L.J. Delsa, Garrison at that time was a judge in the Court of Appeal, and Delsa went up to Garrison's office and said, "Judge, this is over," because every time that one of these the investigators found some evidence that was not what the United States wanted to hear, they just shut it down. "Judge, this is over. I wouldn't do this for, you know, for any amount of money. I quit." And Garrison said, "Don't worry, the truth will come out." And he just stayed calm, stayed focused, kept on being interested to the day that he died, was interested in what happened to President Kennedy. The film came out, JFK, and Garrison was really too sick. He was on his deathbed, really, and so Oliver Stone sent a cassette over for him to look at, and they showed it to him, but he just couldn't focus on it. So he didn't actually, you could say he didn't really see it, because one of the people that viewed it with him told me he really couldn't focus on it. It didn't matter. He didn't want notoriety. He didn't want fame. He didn't want publicity, although many people in New Orleans criticized him for that as a way of, they have of defending Clay Shaw. Garrison is grandstanding. Garrison is anti-gay. Garrison wants publicity, and it wasn't true, not a bit of it.
Many people obviously were introduced to Jim Garrison by the Oliver Stone JFK film. So did we see the real Jim Garrison on the big screen then?
Good question, Kevin. No, you didn't see Jim Garrison, because I don't know what happened there, but I did ask Oliver Stone. I said, you know, this isn't the domestic life, for example. I don't know if you all in the UK know the story, the old situation comedy, Ozzy and Harriet. It's a domestic show where, the idealized marriage, and that's sort of what we had in the film JFK, and it was nothing like what Garrison's life was like, nothing. And I said to Stone, I said, "Well, why didn't you just tell the truth about what his life was like?" Which is sort of my mode, to just tell what you know. And he said, "I could have done that. I could have added 15 minutes and I could have done that." And Kevin Costner playing Garrison, well, I think once Garrison had a fantasy, if he ever were going to be in a film, he'd be played by these old-time actors, Gregory Peck, Robert Mitchum, people of substance like that. Kevin Costner, and I have to say, we have to say, he never bothered to get the accent right. And I mean, you could certainly listen to audios of Garrison making public speeches, and you could have imitated his accent, which was a New Orleans accent, although, as I said, he was born in Iowa, but he grew up in New Orleans. It didn't sound like Garrison. And the other thing that was missing from the film was Garrison's sense of humor. Garrison had a very dry, sardonic sense of humor, and very funny, and did it with a straight face. And we saw none of that. The character in the film is earnest. He's solemn. And Garrison was always ironic and was always satiric. And I try to put in my book as many quotations, examples of Garrison's humor. And when I had to cut the book because it was too long, and the publisher said, "Well, let's just focus on the Kennedy investigation," so a group called JFK Lancer published a book that I did, sort of the outtakes of biography of Jim Garrison, his life up to the investigation, the Kennedy investigation, and just to see what kind of politician he was like, what was he like as a boy in school, in the army, and all of that. And I tried to put in as many of those funny quotes as I possibly could, because it was really, he was hilarious and extremely intelligent, extremely fast, extremely witty, and really a marvelous person in that way. And the film didn't catch that. But the film had a lot to do, and the film was very important. Let's not forget that Oliver Stone also showed great courage to make a story of Jim Garrison. After all, the discrediting of Garrison and the amount of discrediting of Oliver Stone that resulted from that film shows that I think that Stone, in a way, he was right at the top at the time that he made this film. He had won the Academy Award for Platoon. Didn't he also win by then an Academy Award for Born on the 4th of July?
I believe so,
Another film... So too, and all this, and then his name was Mudd, and the New York Times, I think they attacked Stone 6 months before the film was released on a biweekly basis, and attacking and attacking. They managed to get a copy of the script and nonstop attacks on Stone, and he had to defend himself. And he also was being ironic. He called up the publisher of Garrison's memoir On the Trail of the Assassins, and he said, "Why didn't you tell me that so many people hated Jim Garrison?" Well, so many people didn't hate Jim Garrison. It was power that hated Jim Garrison. It was the mainstream press that was attacking Jim Garrison. But Stone suffered as a result of this, and I think that has to go down in history. He did the best he could. And you have to remember, too, that it's a dramatic film. It's a fiction film. It's not a documentary. And there are some composite characters. There are moments when Stone includes a figure called Mr. X that was based on Fletcher Prouty, who didn't know Garrison at the time of Garrison's investigation. So what? And I think this Mr. X figure, played by Donald Sutherland, is in the film to sort of pull together some of the ideas, to summarize what Garrison's investigation has shown up to that point. And there were some speculations, mention of Lyndon Johnson. I don't think any evidence, credible evidence, has emerged even proving that Lyndon Johnson had foreknowledge of the assassination of President Kennedy. I don't see that evidence, so better not to mention it, I would think. But all right, it's a dramatic film. It's just, I would call the film a speculation on the assassination of President Kennedy, focusing on the New Orleans side of the story. If I had made that film or I had advised Stone, I would have put much more in the film about Clinton and Jackson, where Oswald, as I mentioned before, Oswald went up there with Sean Ferry. It's barely in the film. It was cut from the first release of the film, and I think it appears in the director's cut, and we see a little bit about that, but not nearly enough, and not nearly the import that this incident had, which was tremendous.
So basically, then, in your opinion, would you say that Lee Harvey Oswald was unaware that he was part of a plot to kill JFK?
That's a good question, too, and I think it's taken up. The person who took that up best is a novelist, Don DeLillo, in his novel Libra, where he tries to show what Oswald knew and what he didn't know. And DeLillo came to the conclusion that Oswald didn't know, and I think Oswald could not possibly have known. Here he is, working for the FBI, working in the CIA counterintelligence defection program into the Soviet Union. I think what Oswald, training at training camps north of Lake Pontchartrain, what Oswald must have thought was that he was in part of the anti-Castro movement, that he was training as part of the efforts of the CIA to assassinate Castro. All the Cubans were all around. He was involved with Cubans. He had a cover in New Orleans, which was that he was pro-Castro. He was giving out leaflets, Fair Play for Cuba. But when Oswald went up to Jackson and he was sitting in the hospital, this is my own interview, nobody else got the medical director of the hospital, Dr. Frank Silva, came by and sees Oswald, and Oswald is ranting and raving about how he's going to go to Cuba and kill Castro, and that he's going to use all the training that he got in the Marine Corps in order to do that. Well, Dr. Silva happened to have been from Cuba. He had come to the United States before Castro, and he wanted no part of any of this, and he said to himself, there's no way this guy is going to get a job in my hospital. And as a result of that, the CIA planned to embed Oswald in the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson failed. Didn't happen. And, so the CIA can plan, but they can't control the entire world. And so on. And so Garrison had to speculate, finally, why did the CIA want Oswald to get it? Oswald had no idea it was a mental hospital. I was interviewing the barber up there in Clinton. And Oswald goes into the barbershop to get information, and he says, are there any jobs at the hospital? Which is, Clinton and Jackson are very close. And the barber says, do you know this is a mental hospital? And Oswald didn't know it. Garrison is speculating. Well, Oswald was trying, the CIA wanted Oswald to get a job at the mental hospital. Maybe at some point he would go from being an employee to being an inmate, a patient. Then they would have let him escape. And here you would find in Dealey Plaza, apprehended by the Dallas police, a person who escaped from an insane asylum. Now you could really say that Oswald was the psychotic, the lone assassin, the sociopath, and out of his mind, and the lone nut, which is what they say, and which is all in the Warren Report. So you could see the tracings of what that scenario was going to be. unfortunately, for and when the House Select Committee investigators from New Orleans went up to Clinton and Jackson to re-interview all the witnesses, they were not permitted by the committee led by Robert Blakey to interview anybody who had not previously been interviewed. By the way, and one of those people was Frank Silva. So they never got to talk to Dr. Silva, and they never got that story that I just told you about Oswald sitting there in his sloppy T-shirt with the attendants at the hospital ranting and raving about killing Castro. So you don't see that in any of the official records, including anything at the National Archives. So I think, in a way, I did my part. If I did anything, I did that. I had no doubt about the credibility of Dr. Silva. He's an immensely learned, cultivated man, interested in history, interested in literature. No reason to lie about any of this. Not coming forward. I had to track him down, and most gracious, extraordinary man.
And do you believe...
He's been accused of being involved in CIA, what do we call it? The program MKUltra, where they did the mind games on people, and that somehow Dr. Silva was involved with that. He never was. Manipulation of people's consciousness, mind, which has all emerged, of course, in the CIA's torture at Abu Ghraib. And we see there's a marvelous book by a professor named Alfred McCoy called The Question of Torture, which describes the whole history of CIA's being involved in mind experiments relating to the development of psychological torture. But Frank Silva had nothing to do with that. There was a doctor at Tulane who did have something to do with it. His name was Robert Heath, but not Dr. Silva. We got a little bit of far afield there.
No, that's fine. And just to sort of conclude everything then, Joan, will we ever have future records released where we can even learn more about the truth on JFK? Because I did see something that there was some sort of release going on in 2025. What do you know about that?
2025, 2037, I don't know. And it could be. I mean, if I just found this year a document saying that Clay Shaw was highly paid by CIA... There must be other stuff out there that will come to light, that will be discovered by a researcher, and that the government will feel it doesn't matter anymore, and they'll just release the rest of the stuff. And, of course, as against that, the future, is the lack of transparency in the current government of the United States and the Obama administration, which has been worse on issues of transparency and openness of records than the Bush administration had been. And we can see that, I think, if I may say one thing about that, and that is that the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ruled for the Civil Liberties Union in releasing the remaining Abu Ghraib photographs, and CIA balked, and Obama said this will never be released. He went against the ruling of the court, which he had no right to do, which was illegal, and said so that the Second Circuit, realizing that the president had no power to do that, reversed itself. And I will not release those photographs. And I think it's the principle that's important here. I don't know that we need more photographs of Abu Ghraib, but the important point is transparency. Release whatever there is to release. So whether further incriminating CIA or other records will be released, I don't know. But I kind of think somebody will slip. Somebody will let something pass. Somebody will not be careful enough in removing documents from circulation. We also know that many documents have been destroyed. So we don't have everything, and of course not. How could we?
And in your research...
We have a lot.
In your research, Joan, did you come across much disinformation?
Yes. And I came across the creation of disinformation by CIA, and that was the most interesting part of it. And that had to do, getting back to the issue of Clay Shaw's identity as Clay Bertrand, the man who called Dean Andrews and said, go to Dallas and represent Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, Clay Shaw, appeared at the VIP room of Eastern Airlines at Moisant Airport in New Orleans, and Clay Shaw was there signing the guest book, Clay Bertrand. And a person who was in the room at the same time happened to be a CIA asset called Alfred Moran. Well, Moran was at a party, and he told the CIA's second-in-command at the New Orleans CIA field office, Hunter Leak, he said, I saw Sean there. He saw him, Clay Bertrand. Well, and then when Garrison's officers came to talk to Moran, he lied, and he said, no, it wasn't there. But he had told Leak, and Leak told his boss, whose name was Lloyd Ray, and Lloyd Ray sent this information that Shaw signed Bertrand there, and someone saw him, right up to the Office of Legal Counsel of CIA, Lawrence Houston. Well, Houston had to change the record. And so what he did was he sent Leak to talk to Moran and get him to change his story and to deny what he had said. Now, Moran had a slip disk, bad bag, and Leak was told to go to his bedroom, go into his home, sit there, and make sure that you get a denial. No, I never saw Clay Shaw at the Eastern Airlines terminal, which he did. Now, that's an example of the high officer in CIA, the chief counsel, Office of General Counsel, creating disinformation in the CIA files. And there's a lot more. Sometimes CIA tells the truth. They deny that they knew everyone. They deny that Ferry worked for them. They deny. There are many of those documents where we see official denials. But then we see other documents which show that indeed these people were working for CIA. They also lie about when people leave CIA service. Every one of those is a lie. They left in 1956. And of course, it wasn't true. And one of them, William Godet, who was a CIA asset in New Orleans also, at the International Trademark, laughed. And he said, they always say that. I was with them until, you know, way, many, many years later, after the official records say that I left CIA. He considered it a joke, but he's a good witness for the fact that that's one area where they lied constantly. They lied under oath. Richard Helms lied under oath in the case in Chile regarding the overthrow of Allende. A judge chastised him. He didn't care. There's a lot of... They lied that they hadn't debriefed Oswald, as I mentioned. I can't even think of all the lies.
Well,
set the tone.
Well, Joan, where can people get in contact with you? Is there a website you've got to...
Yes, I have two websites, joanmellon.net and joanmellon.com. You can get my book at amazon.com, probably in the UK too, or plain US, and that's called A Farewell to Justice. And you can contact me. Should I give my email address?
Go ahead.
joanmellon@AOL.com, one word, and I'd be happy to answer questions for people who want to look at the book and have further questions.
Well, Joan, thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you, Kevin. I enjoyed it.
Okay, well, my final guest for the show is St. John Hunt, who is the eldest son of super spy E. Howard Hunt, a 27-year career CIA covert agent and foreign station chief, who is most well known as the leader, director of the White House Plumbers Black Bag Team, whose botched burglary and arrest led to the resignation of then-President Richard Nixon. E. Howard Hunt, who passed away at the age of 88, was also involved in many of the CIA's most notorious operations in Cuba and throughout Central and South America. Even more significant, Hunt has direct knowledge of the planning, particulars, participants, and motives in the JFK assassination and has confided this information with his son, St. John Hunt. Without further ado, St. John Hunt, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Kevin, for having me on your show. It's a pleasure and a long-awaited time that we've been trying to do this, so I'm glad to be here today with you.
Well, it's an honor to have you on with us, St. John. So this interview is the story of your father's last confession to you, his son. It's about the plot to assassinate President John F. Kennedy. And your father was involved with Kennedy's murder. Now, that's what he said on his deathbed confession. Is this right, St. John?
Yes, that is correct. He not only said that on his deathbed confession, but he gave me memos, handwritten memos and things detailing what the CIA's involvement. Of course, the CIA not as an above-the-ground group on its own, but... certain elements, renegade elements from the agency that were discussing and making plans for the assassination of President Kennedy. And that's what he told me before he died and left me with a stack of things to share with the world. And so I thank you for for giving me this opportunity to share some of that information and to share the story with your listeners.
Okay, now let's sort of start from a sort of beginning here. Now, your father was an American author, an intelligence officer. Your father, along with others, was one of the White House plumbers, a sort of secret team of operatives, I suppose they were, charged with, fixing leaks. Now, Howard, along with others, engineered the first Watergate burglary and the ensuing sort of Watergate scandal. But he was eventually convicted of the burglary and conspiracy and wiretapping, and he served 33 months in prison. Now,
he did.
What was your father like?
Well, my father, at that point in life, he was a very bitter man. Of course, he felt, as did many in his line of profession, that he should be allowed certain grace in things that he carried out for his government. And as his president Nixon felt equally strongly about, there should be some graces allowed to high members of the government. As a matter of fact, Nixon himself said that if the president does it, it's not illegal. And that's kind of the overall feeling at the White House in those days. We're talking about 1971, 1972, when Nixon was coming up for re-election. He had a very, he had a very tough race, and Nixon was a very petty man in many ways, consumed with fears that there was espionage and dirty tricks going on by the Democrats against him, and so he decided to. Put a team together of his own agents, so that he wouldn't have to go through the standard channels like FBI and things like that. So he charged one of his top aides, Charles Colson, to put together a team of expert intelligence agents. And so Charles Colson knew my father. I think Charles and my father were both alumni from Brown University, I believe. And so my dad at that time, 1971, was still officially working in his capacity there at the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley, Virginia, although his career had pretty much leveled out, and there was not much of a chance for him to be named the director of CIA, which is what eventually my father wanted to be. He wanted to be the CIA top dog. But after the Cuban Missile Crisis, after the Bay of Pigs failure, all the people in the agency that were connected with the Bay of Pigs were kind of put on the back burner. And so my father was kind of dutifully told that his chances at notoriety in the Central Intelligence Agency were curtailed, and that he would have to be satisfied in his current position, which lasted from the mid-60s all the way through to the Nixon era in 1970, when Nixon tapped my father to put together a team of intelligence operatives. My father accepted and felt that this was a second chance for him to further his career not so much as a politician, but as an intelligence operative. So he was very excited about it. In those days, this was really, really super top secret. The reason they called my father's team the plumbers was because they were charged with plugging the leaks that were coming out daily in the New York Times from Daniel Ellsberg, who was leaking massive amounts of documents and papers relating to the Vietnam War. And Nixon was just infuriated by this, and so my father's first task for the White House was to put a team together and find out how these leaks were coming about. Well, it didn't take him too long to put a plan together. He enlisted Gordon Liddy, who was quite a character, worked for the Treasury Department, and his claim to notoriety prior to Watergate was that he was on the team to get Tim Leary being the guru acid god of the counterculture generation, a very influential man with the left-wing liberals and with the drug culture people. So Gordon Liddy and my father brought in some other people. They brought in a gentleman named James McCord, who was also a CIA operative. And then my father handpicked his team of Cubans from the old Bay of Pigs days. And so he had four or five of these gentlemen come up from Miami, Florida, and they drew up a huge, very expensive plan called Gemstone. And Watergate was really only one tiny portion of this overall plan that included they had large yachts, houseboats moored there in Miami Beach, where the Democratic National Convention was going to take place. They had full on cameras and two way mirrors, and they hired prostitutes to lure the Democratic candidates and their workers, anybody they could, down to the boat to do cocaine and have sex, and they were going to film all this stuff. I mean, they had these outrageous plans, and some of them they actually pulled off, like Watergate. They also broke into the to Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in Los Angeles and rifled through his personal files from his doctor patient files, and trying to find anything that could smear Daniel Ellsberg in the press. So there was a lot of dirty campaign things going on. I mean, people nowadays they hear what candidates say about each other, and they're all shocked that there's a lot of dirt being smeared around. But in those days, it wasn't so much public dirt. The dirt you smeared was behind the scenes, and people could get a hold of some bit of information from your past, or some skeleton you might have in your closet, and then they would use that against you and make you do all sorts of things.
You know, it's just incredible to listen to what you've got to say. I suppose, would you class your father then as a sort of international assassin on behalf of the government at the time?
Yes, that's a very appropriate term, international assassin, in both senses, in the sense that we were just talking about, personal character assassination, as well as the physical part of assassination. He was in his days at the CIA during early 60s, and prior to that, I would say starting in 1954 and 55, he was charged with political assassinations worldwide, and he was part of this top secret group called Executive Action, which was a euphemism for murder and assassination. And he was privy to all those goings on, and had a lot to do with the American mafia assassination plots against Castro in Cuba, and the death of quite a few political leaders worldwide that weren't friendly to the United States. This rogue band of assassins. So an assassin he definitely was. I don't know about him pulling the trigger on anybody specifically, but he was a man that got this project through. And was ultimately in control of quite a bit of it.
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, you said there that he sort of never pulled the trigger, but he must have been responsible for a lot of people's death then.
He was responsible in a secondary way for thousands and thousands of deaths from regular citizens all around the world. For example, when he engineered and ran the successful coup of the Guatemalan government in 1957. They came in there, and it was a beautifully simple operation. I mean, they had recordings of fake. They had recordings of airplanes coming in, and they cut into the radio stations. You know, they overrode the radio station signals, and then they made these announcements, which my father had written up for the announcers to make, and they said, the planes are coming, and that you'd hear planes, dozens of planes in the background. Well, there were no planes. It was was very masterfully carried out, but they did have a ragtag army of freedom fighters, shall we call them. That's what we call them here. We call them freedom fighters. They're really nothing more than just mercenaries and military guys that are working for money for the United States, but we call them freedom fighters, and they took over Guatemala. And as a result of that, of my father's involvement in that, 20, 30, 40,000 leftists, liberals were killed because of that. And I asked him about that in his later years, and he said, well, that's just something that that has to occur, and people die during war. And I said, well, Papa, and I called him Papa, I said, Papa, you don't feel any guilt or remorse for that? And he goes, no, you just have to, put that all aside. So he wasn't a man that was prone to feeling guilty about things that he did. He was always able to justify his actions.
And I guess they got that kind of man in that kind of job because of, the kind of, psyche that he had to sort of be able to be able to, perform that kind of job.
Right, right. They're not going to pick somebody that's straddling the fence of guilt and shame. Should I do it or shouldn't I do it? They had to have men that were that would just move and pull a trigger at the drop of a dime. Never a thought in their minds as to what is the long term effect of this going to be? And as we can see now, the long term effect of the United States being involved in so many illegal coups and dirty deeds to many, many countries, including the Middle East countries, Iran, Iraq, and all those places. Now we see that the long-term effects are, of course, that we're hated almost unanimously around the world. We don't have the support that we pretend to have. But as long as the media is willing to spin the tales and continue saying, United States and our great allies, I think not much is going to change.
Why is the sort of, say, JFK subject so important to everyone? Why should people, or how can people sort of relate that to the modern-day problems that we see ourselves in?
That is a very good question. I can only speculate that that your average person, I don't know, I think the average person, I think the majority of people in recent polls still believe that JFK was murdered as a result of a conspiracy.
Of course.
Although there's been so many so many conspiracy theories and plots, and a lot of it's disinformation put out by people that don't want the truth to come out, that it's gotten very confusing and sort of too much to almost deal with. But I think what's important to people, at least maybe older people my age, I don't know if it's so much important anymore to the younger generation of people, but it does represent a moment for the United States, a moment in time where our freely elected government was taken over by the military industrial complex for the sole purpose of eventually becoming a rather than just be a democracy, it would have to be an oligarchy, so to speak, and at least a country that is now well on its way to being run as a corporation. So I think if people actually found out, or if we could settle this JFK issue once and for all, which I don't think is ever going to happen, because first of all, the United States government, whether it's under the Obama presidency or anybody, is never going to allow, is never going to put out a statement saying, well, yes, certain elements of our own government did away with President John F. Kennedy. That would just be too shameful on the worldwide stage. And so that's. I don't think that's ever going to be admitted. Although that's exactly what does need to be admitted, so that we can close that chapter in our history and move on with other things, and try to rectify some of the things that we did as a result of that coup d'état.
Well, one of the sort of facts that your father spoke about, well, I say facts, one of what he confessed to, and one of the confessions that your father came out with was that he was a point man in the Dealey Plaza. Now, is he saying there that he was one of the snipers?
No, he's not saying he was one of the snipers, but what he was saying was that he was there in the overall, in the position to make sure that the people involved on the street, be it the people that were dressed up as policemen or that had false identifications as Secret Service agents to help the team of shooters or the teams of shooters be able to exit Dealey Plaza. He was there in the capacity to make sure that everything went according to plan and that people were able to move in and out of Dealey Plaza in a timely fashion, that people were able to get to their planes in a timely fashion, to get to their cars in a timely fashion, and to generally oversee all the goings on that were occurring at that time. It was those were his skills. His skills were in bringing the team there. He was also in charge of financially. Paying off some of the members of one of the teams for their participation in it, and then he was gone like a shadow.
So, in the words of your father, then the actual day that JFK was killed, yeah, in Dealey Plaza, what occurred? If it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald that murdered JFK, the president, who did?
Well, my father named an assassin. His name has come up before, but having someone like my father name this gentleman was very profound. He named a professional French assassin that worked for the underground French underworld in Marseille. And this gentleman's name was one of the assassins. His name was Lucien Sarti, and he was brought in by my father told me by Bill Harvey and Cord Meyer. Bill Harvey was the station chief in Rome, and Cord Meyer was the station chief in London, actually. And they both had a lot of connections and an open relationship with the French underworld in Corsica and in Marseille, and he was recommended, and then he was brought in by Bill Harvey. So my father believed that this gentleman Lucien Sarti was in fact the one of the gunmen behind the picket fence up there by the grassy knoll that probably killed Kennedy with the fatal headshot coming from the front. Of course, you know, for everything I say, there's going to be, you know, another person or dozens of people saying, well, no, it wasn't him, it wasn't that way. But this is what my father told me, and he was there, and he was, you know, part of the original discussions about the killing of JFK. He attended several meetings in safe houses in and around Miami, Florida, in the year prior to the assassination, where they were setting up plans and fleshing things out and putting all the details and all the people together for this assassination.
Okay.
Which was originally supposed to have been carried out in Florida, but was moved to Dallas. Later on.
Okay, so did Lee Harvey Oswald, did he actually fire a shot which did name the president, or was his whole pardon it just as he said a patsy?
Well, you know, there's a lot of speculation about it. Now, my father didn't actually say whether Oswald was able to fire a shot or not. Of course, we know that there was no stains on Lee Harvey Oswald when they arrested him, and if you fired a weapon, they're going to find you know, trace elements of gunpowder on your cheek, especially if you're using a rifle like the one Oswald was purported to use. I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald probably never got off a shot at all.
Okay,
he was just there to build up as the patsy. I mean, they had him doing all kinds of things, which were to support his story that he was a left wing Marxist that purchased a gun from a magazine article and then posed behind his house with his left wing literature and his rifle. I mean, it was just a beautiful little operation in that sense. And to this day, of course, Oswald is known to be the assassin of JFK. But I don't believe he was. And I think my father, in telling me that Lucien Sarti fired the fatal shot, I think he concurs with at least Oswald wasn't the actual murderer of Kennedy.
No. And this French assassin, gunman, I mean, he's never been located, has he?
He was never located directly after that. He was flown out of Dallas. There's been evidence, testimony given by people that he had flown out of Dallas, and he ended up dying in a shootout in 1971, I believe, with Mexican police in Mexico. So his life was, you know, he was on the run. I think probably he was certainly in fear for his life. A lot of people that were connected to this operation have died violent deaths, mysterious deaths, and Oswald was the first to go, so that he wouldn't have been able to testify that he was working for his CIA handlers, and a long line of people that were connected that had any sort of action that was opposed to the Warren Commission's verdict wound up dying violent and mysterious deaths. Lucien Sarti was one of the many.
Obviously, you know, Jack Ruby, who shot Oswald, was the next to die in mysterious circumstances within the prison. I mean, obviously, you know, he died of cancer, but it all came on quite suddenly, didn't it?
Yes, quite suddenly. The belief is amongst conspiracy theorists is that he was given a cancer-inducing agents, either from injection or through some other means. But they certainly had the ability to do that, and he had begged the Warren Commission to please take him from Dallas and to protective custody in Washington, D.C., where he was willing to explain the whole entire story. And one of the things that we did get from Jack Ruby was there's a short film clip of him being transferred from one point to another, and he says that if the other vice president, if the other runner-up for vice president, I forget what his name was, of course, the vice president under Kennedy was Lyndon Baines Johnson, but there was another one that was up for the offering, and Jack Ruby is quoted as saying if he had been vice president, John F. Kennedy would still be alive today. So that was Jack Ruby's little jewel tip for implicating LBJ as being the ultimate source of this conspiracy.
And LBJ again became the next heir to the sort of presidency when he was sworn in hours after the JFK murder.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so now one other thing about the Daily Plaza. Now, was it your father that said to you that he had been one of the sort of three tramps that could have been pictured at the Daily Plaza, or was that something that you sort of threaded together yourself after seeing some pictures of the tramps that were taken on the day of the murder of JFK?
Well, I did see some pictures of those tramps, and one of them does look incredibly like my father, and I thought, you know, it was my father for many, many years. He always denied it, and it still remains somewhat of a mystery. I think we've had recently several men that have come forward and said that they, in fact, were the tramps. But now we have too many men. We have, for three tramps, I think we have a total of 9 people that have said that they were the tramps. So here again, we've got a situation where there's too much information, and people trying to, you know, to look into this are just overwhelmed with so many points of view that it's hard to tell. But I've seen some photographs recently of a gentleman photographed in Dealey Plaza that looks amazingly like my father. It's not one of the tramp pictures, and it certainly looks just as much like my father as the old tramp did to me. And so there is that. It would be unlikely that my father would have been dressed in a hobo's outfit and be lurking about in an abandoned train car directly behind the grassy knoll. But it was a good location for an escape, and the shooters that were behind the picket fence above the grassy knoll did use that train yard as their escape. But I'm not really sure in what capacity the three tramps served.
Okay, so when you eventually had this confession tape, did your father ever think of the risks that he was putting yourself and your family in for having possession of such a tape?
No. Well, I can't say what may have been going through his mind. I do know that at one point we discussed the risks of him coming out with this information, and for a very short time in his last years, he was ready and had every intention of bringing this information out in a major media press conference, and this was going to be followed by an autobiography of truth, and he was going to name names and really kind of settle things for himself and a lot of people. But that motivation, that strength that he had, weakened over time when under pressure from his attorneys, under pressure from his immediate family, and then all I was left with was this tape that he had sent me and his handwritten messages, and his final words to me was that he was deeply sorry that he couldn't follow through with this with me, and that he was leaving it in my hands to bring to the world after he passed away, which is what was what my intention was, and what I have tried to do since his passing in 2007.
Well, of course. I mean, which wasn't too long ago, really. When you're looking at 4 years ago, really, and I bet it doesn't seem like yesterday for you, to be honest. So let's just talk about the tape just quickly. We're going to play the tape out, but just for our audience, because it's the first time. I don't know if this story is broken in the UK before, really. Is this your sort of first interview for this tape?
Yes, I think so.
Yes, in the UK, right, okay.
Yes, in the UK.
Well, let's just sort of lay it out. What does your father talk about on the tape?
Well, I have not heard the tape for a while, but as I recall, I'll tell you the backstory to the tape. I had just spent some time with my father, and he had been laying out the details of this information regarding JFK to me. He'd written several pages of handwritten memos and notes and things, and then I had to come back to California, and we were going to continue our secret project when I returned to Miami later on in the year. But in the meantime, I went to my mailbox one afternoon to pick up my mail, and there was a small package in there, and I opened it up. It was from my father, and it had a cassette tape in it, and there was nothing written on the cassette tape, no note attached to it. And so I went home, and I put it in my little cassette playing box, and he starts, you can hear him breathing, and he's kind of fidgeting with this handheld on-off switch. He sounded pretty sick at the time. His head was clear, but his body was starting to fail him, or it was actually failing him quite rapidly. And he started talking about the big event, which was his code name for the JFK assassination, and he talked about some of the people that were involved in it, and then he speaks about the fact that he's giving this information to me and me alone, and so you'll just have to hear it.
Okay, and at the time when he made this tape, he wasn't under any sort of drugs or sort of any sort of hard medication, was he?
No, nothing of that sort. I mean, he was taking antibiotics for his pneumonia and things like that. He was probably taking some, pills to help him sleep at night. But his mind was sharp. He was, his body had failed him, but his mental alertness and quickness were there with him to the very end.
Okay, well, here's the voice of E. Howard Hunt, father of our guest, St. John Hunt. There's a sort of larger version on the Moore Show website, so just go to the St. John interview page. Here it is.
I heard from Frank that LBJ had designated Cord Meyer Jr. to undertake a larger organization while keeping it totally secret. Cord Meyer himself was a rather favored member of the Eastern aristocracy. He was a graduate of Yale University and had joined the Marine Corps during the war and lost an eye in the Pacific fighting. I think that LBJ settled on Meyer as an opportunist, Perrin like himself, Perrin, and a man who had very little left to him in life ever since JFK had taken Cord's wife as one of his mistresses. I would suggest that Cord Meyer welcomed the approach from LBJ, who was, after all, only the vice president at that time. And, of course, could not number Cord Meyer among JFK's admirers. Quite the contrary. As for Dave Phillips, I knew him pretty well at one time. He worked for me during the Guatemala project. He had made himself useful to the agency in Santiago, Chile, where he was an American businessman. In any case, his actions, whatever they were, came to the attention of the Santiago station chief. And when his resume became known to people in the Western Hemisphere Division, he was brought in to work on Guatemalan operations. Sturges and Morales and people of that ilk stayed in apartment houses during preparations for the big event. Their addresses were very subject to change, so that where a fellow like Morales had been one day, you're not necessarily associated with that same address the following day. In short, it was a very mobile experience. Let me point out at this point that if I had wanted to fictionalize what went on in Miami and elsewhere during the run-up for the big event, I would have done so. But I don't want any unreality to tinge this particular story, or the information, I should say. I was a bench warmer on it, and I had a reputation for honesty. I think it's essential to refocus on what this information that I've been providing you, and you alone, by the way, consists of. What is important in the story is that we've backtracked the chain of command up through Cord Meyer and laying the the doings at the doorstep of LBJ. He, in my opinion, had an almost maniacal urge to become president. He regarded JFK as he was, in fact, an obstacle to achieving that. He could have waited for JFK to finish out his term and then undoubtedly a second term. So that would have put LBJ at the head of a long list of people who were waiting for some change in the executive branch.
Pretty amazing stuff there. So again, the big event was the murder of JFK. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct. That was the working title, as it were, for that plan.
Okay. Now, like you've said before, St. John, you don't believe he was anywhere involved in sort of pulling the triggers that killed JFK. But again, he was obviously involved, like he confessed there, to the orchestration of the whole plan or part of the bigger picture.
Yes, that's correct. He called himself a bench warmer, and I think that's a term that there's a term in CIA jargon called limited hangout, and what that is someone who's willing to discuss their own involvement in an operation, but not fully, and so they're going to give you a kind of a limited edition or a limited version of what the truth is. It's going to be truthful, but they're not going to tell you as to, perhaps they won't disclose the full extent of that person's involvement. So when my father refers to himself as a bench warmer, a planner, he was giving us limited hangout. In other words, he was telling us that he was there, that he was involved, and that he was one of the key planners of that operation, but he didn't go further into saying exactly what the day-to-day details were. He does speak on the tape about meeting in safe houses in and around Florida with David Morales and Frank Sturgis. David Morales is one of the they called him the Indian, and he was a big Indian fellow, I think Mexican Indian, and he'd been in the CIA's executive action plan for many years. He worked under my father in the Guatemalan campaign, and he became known as one of the CIA's top assassins in Latin America. He also worked for Bill Harvey, another of the planners, and worked at the secret CIA station in Miami called JM Wave. Morales himself confessed to being involved in the assassination to his longtime best friend, a gentleman by the name of Ruben Carbajal, who's been interviewed and said, yes, Dave Morales said that we took care of that SOB Kennedy. Dave Morales was prone to drinking and talking too much when he drank, and he also died mysteriously. He was due to be subpoenaed and testify about CIA activities, and he died quite suddenly of a heart attack, I believe. And he was fit as a bull, you know. Bill Harvey was, according to my father, a two-fisted, gun-toting alcoholic psycho. But hated the Kennedys. Of course, my father hated the Kennedys. A lot of the CIA people hated the Kennedys, including all the Cubans. So you have this renegade executive action group already set up and doing assassinations on a global scale, and then you have the shame and the defeat of their prized baby, the overthrow of Castro in Cuba, which failed, and the people blamed Kennedy for that failure, and they made up their minds right then and there that Kennedy was the wrong person to lead this country in the next years to come, especially when there was so much at stake in Vietnam and in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia. He was felt to be soft on communism, and really, John Kennedy was way ahead of himself in terms of his ideals and
oh, yes,
and what he felt was good.
That's right.
So I think even today he would be considered a danger, because the same, it's not that the same people run the country that, you know, today that ran the country in 1963, but these people are all graduates of the same school of thought. And so as long as you have this school of thought that's there and in place, you're going to have, I mean, these people could be, their names could be interchangeable, whether it's Lyndon Johnson or George W. Bush. I mean, it doesn't really make any difference. They both come from the same school of thought, and that school of thought is for the U.S. to be a worldwide dominant force by any means necessary. So that's how this kind of conspiracy can go on for so long, because you have the same people, or different people with the same mentality, I should say, you know, coming through this sort of proverbial school of you know, corporate and elitist, almost like a dictatorship. We're far from being the free, loving democracy that we pretend to be.
So would you say then, St. John, that your father did believe that everything in the end went back to LBJ? You know, is that an opinion of your father? Did he think that?
Yes, he firmly thought that, believed that, and spoke to me about that. He wrote it down in his memos. He said you had to have LBJ was, well, according to my father, LBJ was one of the most corrupt and criminal politicians to ever set foot in the Senate or in Congress, and certainly in the White House. He had a long history of corrupt dealings throughout his time as a U.S. senator, and really was the perfect person. Of course, you had to have Johnson's support in for the assassination. Although Johnson, I'm sure, wasn't privy or even at any meetings where the details were being planned out. That was not his. That was not what he was. That was not what he should be doing. What he needed to do was appoint the right people to the Warren Commission that would send in the right verdict and the right story, paint the right picture for the American people. And you also had to have the support of the FBI. And, of course, Johnson's best longtime friend was J. Edgar Hoover, who was not only Johnson's personal friend for many, many years, but also was his neighbor, and had arranged a deal with Johnson that if Johnson could count on Hoover's support in investigating the assassination in a limited way, that would come up with Oswald as being the assassin, then Johnson was prepared to give Hoover a lifetime seat as the head of the FBI, because under Kennedy, Hoover was going to be forced to retire in the next year. And once Kennedy was out of the way, of course, J. Edgar Hoover got his lifetime position as director of the FBI under Johnson's administration. So everybody got something from this assassination.
Yeah. No, well, I was just going to say that. I mean, you know, going on this LBJ thread. I mean, you know, I mean, I heard from speaking to someone else as well about the Madeleine Duncan Brown books. You know, she did state in her book, Madeleine Duncan Brown did, that the night before the Kennedy assassination, that Lyndon Baines Johnson met with the FBI, Dallas tycoons, you know, organized crime kingpins in a conference, and sort of emerged from that conference to sort of tell his mistress at the time, Madeleine, that those SOBs, the Kennedys, I think he was referring to, would never embarrass him again, and you know, and that was a promise.
Yeah,
that's kind of strange.
I've heard that too. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting is that some of the people that have stories to tell are not particularly politicians or police officers or FBI investigators or prosecutors or DAs or anything. Some of the people with the best information are people like LBJ's mistress. Or someone like myself, because we're the only people that could catch these men, LBJ or my father, E. Howard Hunt, in a different mood when they were relaxing, when they were less pressured, and so I think there's a lot of information to be culled from sons and daughters of some of these people that were involved in this assassination. Certainly myself, and certainly LBJ's mistress. You know, you get little details just like that. You know, LBJ comes out of the meeting and he goes hangs out with his mistress, and they're drinking, and he's getting relaxed, and he's probably had a great big sigh. You know, oh, those damn SOB Kennedy brothers aren't going to embarrass me anymore after tomorrow, and that's a promise. You know, just a little sentence like that just kind of, you know, comes out, and she's there to hear it, and then boom, tomorrow. I mean, the next day, you know, the Kennedy JFK goes down, and it all comes together in her mind. She's like, probably like I was, like, oh my God.
Yep. But again, it receives very little or no media attention.
Right, and the media attention when it does come out, people like Madeleine Brown and myself, or Marita Lorenz, who had the details of her. The things that she and Frank Sturgis did, bringing up guns into Dallas 2 days before the assassination, meeting my father in a motel room where he handed over a large envelope full of cash to pay them for what they did. We are ridiculed, you know, by the media, and told that we're in the media, and the media is told that we aren't reliable, that. Madeleine Duncan Brown, she's an alcoholic, or St. John Hunt, he's not reliable. He's, you know, he had, you know, problems as a child, or Marita Lorenz. Well, she's just trying to make a buck and concocting these crazy stories. And so, you know, that's how people are assassinated. Their characters are assassinated.
Can I ask you though, John? Sorry to butt in here, but why does the media do that?
Well, because the media, to a great part, is controlled by conservatives, and the conservative they control a lot of publishing. They control a lot of the radio stations. I think 80% of all radio stations in the United States, or more than 80%, are of conservative, you know, coming from you know, conservative monies. You've got a few stations. You've got a few. A few people like Alex Jones or George Nouria and Coast to Coast Radio. Alex Jones out of Texas, and you know, but for the most part, it's the conservatives that are running the media and the press, and they're not going to stand for anybody to be believable that says that the United States killed its own president. And I'll give you an example in modern times of how this works. We have a show, cable show here in the United States called the History Channel. And about 8 or 9 years ago, the History Channel ran a JFK assassination special where they aired an 8-part series, I think, which was French in origin, or European certainly, called The Men Who Killed Kennedy. And one of the segments, one of the hour-long segments, dealt with Lyndon Johnson's involvement, or alleged involvement, I should say, in the assassination of President Kennedy. And it did discuss Madeleine Brown's testimony, and it did discuss the fact that Johnson was a very corrupt a criminal who had a number of people killed that stood in his way in the early 50s and the late 40s, so when he was making his rise to power in Texas, in the Texas political circles. And that episode, ex-President Gerald Ford at the time, and Lady Bird Johnson, LBJ's wife, and a couple other people, influential people, wrote letters to Time Warner that ultimately owned that station and that show, and said, you know, you have to take this off. You can't ever air this again. And you know, we would, you know, for the sake of the country, for the sake of our children, and blah blah blah. And so they pulled that one episode. And now when you go online to order The Men Who Killed Kennedy from the History Channel website, what you will get is all of the seven episodes, but you will not get the eighth episode. And that now, that episode has been officially stamped out, and it's very difficult to get in this country anyways. So that kind of thing keeps this conspiracy shut down. And that's why you still have people like myself and yourself that that are so intent on getting the truth out, because there's so much we're just little guys, and we have to face these big conglomerates that control the media and the spin they put on things.
Well, one other sort of quick question, and well, to get your opinion on about the LBJ subject, and we'll leave it alone after this, is, there's a sort of famous photograph on the Air Force One where Congressman, I think it was Albert Thomas, sort of winks back at a quick-smiling LBJ as he's being sworn in as the next president of the United States, while the sort of blood-stained, grief-stricken, Jackie Kennedy stands next to him. It's a kind of odd photo, and we're going to post this photo onto the your page on our website as well.
Good. Yeah, I've seen the photo. It's very telling. It's one of those, just absolutely miraculous shots that someone picked up there on the plane, and it catches just that moment of, it's just so obvious. It's the wink. It's like, we did it. This is the wink. I mean, it would be very inappropriate to be winking and smirking under these circumstances, but
yeah.
These men were very, very happy with the outcome. And of course, the body was JFK's body was stolen illegally from Parkland Hospital in Dallas by the Secret Service, who were ordered to do so by Johnson, and brought to Bethesda Naval Hospital near Washington D.C. so that then the right people could conduct the autopsy, and the switchboard operator at the hospital has testified that in fact the President Johnson actually called into the autopsy room and was speaking with General Humes. I mean, they had these guys performing the autopsies that hadn't really had any actual experience performing gunshot wound autopsies. These were getting pencil pushing, metal-wearing, top brass guys that performed the autopsy, and Johnson had people there to not probe the headshot wound. They falsified the photographs of the skull. It just went on and on. But they had to get the body out of Dallas and into their own control in Washington, D.C. in order to buy the autopsy record. That lady, any conspiracy, people say, well, it's the mafia. Well, I'm sorry, you have a reason to kill Kennedy, but the mafia itself had no control over Kennedy's body. They did not have falsified the medical reports, the autopsy material. They had no control over the doctors. They're performing this very loose and minor autopsy that they did. They could not pick people on the Warren Commission. They could not control the FBI's investigation of the crime. So the mafia, although it's a very romantic notion that the mafia wanted to get back at John F. Kennedy for costing them millions and millions of dollars in Cuba when Kennedy lost Cuba and it went to Castro, mob lost tens of millions of dollars, but it's just a romantic notion. They in no way had the kind of clout to run the cover up. The crime itself wasn't such a big deal. What really is a big deal is the cover up after the crime, and that's where you can really pick out who was an accomplice in that. whether it was Oswald who made a shot, or whether it was Lucien Sarti that did the final shot, or whether it was one of the tramps, or whether it was Woody Harrelson's father, or, you know, those are really minor details compared to the conspiracy to cover up the truth after the murder.
Sure.
And that's where the real crime lies. So, in my opinion, you have Lyndon Johnson at the head of that line of people that were in charge, J. Edgar Hoover, of course, and the medical establishment there at Parkland Hospital, at Bethesda Naval Hospital. These people, the people on the Warren Commission, these were the people, really the real criminals, that wove this tale of Oswald and three shots fired from the back, and one shot hit the head, and another bullet caused seven or eight wounds in two bodies, yet was left in absolute pristine condition. It was the people that put these stories, that developed these stories and manufactured this evidence and changed the X-ray photographs and switched the material. These are the people that really are the real criminals, and these are the people that had ultimately had control over the outcome of the assassination. And those people are all well connected. Their sons and daughters are well connected. Their names are well connected. Their money is still connected with the things that are going on today.
Do you think some of this information on his deathbed could have been disinformation?
No, and here's why. Although my father was an expert in disinformation campaigns, if my father had wanted to die with and put his final his deathbed confession, if he wanted to manufacture anything involving Kennedy's assassination, he would have, because ultimately, in the end, my father was, he felt he was, in his own mind, a patriot for the United States. He felt that that the CIA, although the CIA did spurn him in his later years, and although Richard Nixon, as the president, did not pardon my father, which he was fully expecting to be pardoned, he ultimately was a patriot for the United States of America, and there is no way that he would have incriminated his own agency and some of his own people that he had worked with for years in an assassination against the American president. If he were to have said anything in terms of disinformation, he would have made up some crazy story that it was it was Russia. It was the Russians that trained Oswald, and Russian was acting as a Soviet agent, because that was some of the things he used to say to me when I was growing up. He'd go, "Well, you know that Oswald was a Soviet agent when was trained by the KGB in Russia, and he came back and he assassinated Kennedy because he was working for the Russians." So, my father would have without a doubt named the communists as being the people that assassinated Kennedy. There's no way in the world he would have named his own people unless it was the truth.
And also, St. John, you've brought a book out to document your father's information that he gave to you just before he died as well. What's the book called again, St. John?
It's called Bond of Secrecy.
Now you've had major problems having this book published, haven't you?
I have, as a matter of fact. I had a very very capable New York literary agent who held the book for a couple of years, and we had signed an agreement that I was not to, to go to any other literary agent or any other source for publication. So he had the book under his control for several years, and after several years, he claimed he was unable to market the book. It was not marketable, and it's been hard to find major publishing houses that will take the book on, probably because it has such a clear statement about who was responsible for the murder of JFK. coming from someone that would know, namely my father. But I continue to hope that that there'll be someone out there that's you know, that's willing to take the risk.
Yeah.
Certainly, the book is available though from me on my website, which is and here's my plug here for your show. It's www.stjohnhunt.com, spelled out S-A-I-N-T-J-O-H-N-H-U-N-T. www.stjohnhunt.com, and go on my website. You can hear my my father's full confession on the from the tape that he sent me, and you can order my book as a as an ebook, which you can download our on your computer for a few dollars, or you can get the manuscript signed to you by myself. So if some of your readers are interested in reading about the drama of you know, the backstories behind all this stuff. It's a good read, I've been told, and a lot of people in America, at least, have been very supportive of my efforts.
No, it's a very good read, because I've read most of the book. I mean, my time's pretty busy as it is between university and everything else that I'm doing, but I have had a chance to go through the book, and I found it very compelling. And I guess you would say that... this book as well is probably dedicated as much not just to your father but to your mother as well.
Yes, yeah, it certainly is. My mother was she should have a book written about her. You know, her own life was just amazing. She was a secret agent, a spy, contract agent for the CIA. For the American government, and she had a lot of her own very interesting things that she was doing for the government. And of course, she was my father and mother were the classic CIA couple, married couple, going about the world, maintaining their cover as American diplomats, when in fact they were agents for the CIA. And of course, my mother was a very, very strong woman, a very savvy woman, and died as a result of the fact that she was who she was. There was a period during Watergate where my father was in jail. We couldn't make bail. We'd run out of funds, and for a while, Nixon was paying off my father. My mother was picking up the money from one of Nixon's people, meeting this gentleman that had been hired by the White House to take the cash, so she was meeting this guy, and they were setting off drop locations for the funds, and she was going to. Bus terminals at 3 a.m, dark parking lots, fishing for envelopes under parked cars or on top of or behind telephone booths or in lockers at bus stations or airport terminals for months. And she would take the cash and bring it to the house, and then they would sort it out, and then she would go on and get the money to Gordon Liddy's people, to James McCord's family, and all the Cubans. There was 4 Cubans that were involved in Watergate, and there was a couple of $1 million that went through her hands to as payoff money, hush money, and then it stopped. And so my father and mother had evidence. My mother had the evidence linking money from President Nixon's personal war chest of monies to finance the Watergate operation and all the other operations that had been financed. They had canceled checks from Nixon's account at the Committee to Reelect the President, and so they used this as leverage. As some people would call it blackmail, but in any event, they used this and they sent the message from my father through my mother to President Nixon, saying that if the monies didn't continue flowing, that people were going to start talking, and the whole thing was just going to come down, and they were going to bring Nixon down too. Well, my mother was taking a large sum of money to Chicago on a plane flight in December 1972. And coincidentally, the plane just happened to have been rerouted to another airport, an older airport, an airport that, for all intent and purposes, had been closed, and was told to land on a runway which was ill-equipped, whose lights had mysteriously been turned off on that final approach, and whose team up in the tower cut off all communications with the plane after sending them the wrong landing information, and the plane crashed in a residential area and killed my mother. A lot of things happened in the moments after that plane crash. Within 15 minutes, there was 50 agents, both from the FBI and the Defense Intelligence Agency, on the ground, cordoning off a huge area strewn with debris by the firemen that showed up. The police, Chicago police that showed up, were told to stand down until these agents were through looking for something. They were looking for something. What they were looking for was the briefcase that my mother had sitting on a seat next to her, that had these canceled checks linking President Nixon's money to the Watergate burglary. That's what my mother and father were going to use as blackmail money to continue the funds to support the Cubans and all the people involved in Watergate that were sitting in prison and unable to earn a living to provide for their families. So that hush money and that was it. There was no doubt in my mind, especially from the many years of research, I've come to the conclusion that plane was sabotaged. There was testimony that it had actually blown up in the air about 100, 200 feet over treetops, rather than crash and then blow up in the ground. And they must have had a bomb set aboard that flight that was activated by an altimeter. So as the plane rose on takeoff from Washington, D.C., it sets the on switch, and then when it drops below a certain level, then it detonates. And for example, the very next day, December 9th, 1972, President Nixon installed one of his most loyal cronies, a guy by the name of Eagle Crow, into the position of head of the National NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, which would oversee any investigation on domestic airline crashes. So Nixon had his top guy there the very next day to run the investigation on that flight crash. There was just so many things, the FBI being there, anticipating the plane, because they were there ahead of the police, and a letter that came out later from the Chicago FBI chief saying never in his long years of history with the FBI had he ever been able to assemble that many agents on a location without prior knowledge. So those FBI agents were rounded up and told to wait for the moment, and then they were given the order to go and seal off the area until they could find what they were looking for.
I mean, I can't imagine what it must have been like for you, St. John, to have lost, to have lost your mother the way that she, the way you did. I mean, obviously, you know, she's given you the sort of strength, as well as your father, to sort of, you know, carry on and continue their work in this book. Yeah, I mean, has anything sort of strange ever happened to you at all? I mean, we have to be very quick here, but
after right around the time that Rolling Stone was going to break the story, they're the only major magazine in America that ran any story about what my father told me. There was an attempt to run me off a road, a very dark road up here where I live, and then the house that I was renting a room in, living there at the time, was broken into with no visible signs of broken glass or anything, but it was professionally done, and lots of papers and drawers were gone through, no jewelry or other, nothing was stolen, so it wasn't like somebody was trying to steal VCRs or DVDs to get drugs. It was, they were looking for paperwork, they were looking for probably the information that my father had given me.
Well, St. John, all I can say is thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks really so much for having me on your show.
Thank you very, very much. Take care. To find out more information on St. John, go to stjohnhunt.com, or our previous guest, which was Joan Millen, go to joanmillen.net, or visit my site, themoreshow.co.uk, and look up St. John and Joan Millen under past guests. Well, until next time, be safe.